Today on the 21st Show, Steve Inskeep is known to millions of NPR listeners as a longtime co-host of Morning Edition, but he's also written three books on American history of the 1800s. His most recent tells stories of Abraham Lincoln as a politician navigating disagreements before and during the Civil War.
He was Honest Abe, who didn't go around lying, but would withhold things. And sometimes people would feel that he was in fact deceptive in that way.
The book is called Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. I'm Brian Mackey with Steve Inskeep for The Hour, today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest today for the hour is Steve Inskeep. I'm guessing for a public radio audience, he needs little introduction. He is up way before I am most days as one of the hosts of Morning Edition. He's also reported from around the world, including South Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. But more to the point for our program today, he's the author of several books of American history. Those include Jackson Land, about President Andrew Jackson and Cherokee Chief John Ross, Imperfect Union, about old-timey celebrity couple Jesse and John Fremont, and most recently, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America, which will be our main topic today. All works of history are as much about the present as they are the past. That will come up in our conversation. I spoke with Inskeep last week for a live virtual event that was open to supporters of public radio stations across Illinois. Toward the end of the hour, we'll hear a few questions people submitted during that event. With that said, Steve Inskeep, welcome. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I hope I sound okay. I just adjusted the microphone a little bit. Sounds all right?
Sounds good to me. It does.
Fantastic.
Thanks so much. So I'm a lifelong Illinoisan. I've lived in an apartment 6 blocks from the only home Lincoln ever owned. You, I understand, grew up in one of those other states that claims some Lincoln heritage.
Another letter I.
One of those other states. What was your experience of Lincoln as a young man?
We got a lot of Lincoln propaganda in Indiana, and people did stress the Indiana part of his life. I got to confess, when I was growing up, I was thinking we seem to be the lesser state here because he was born in Kentucky, and then he did all his famous stuff in Illinois. But his early life in Indiana is really fascinating, and it's one of the most moving parts of his story, because when he was 7, his family, which was not well off at all, packed up their stuff. His father had lost the family farm, and they went across the Ohio into southern Indiana, which was then wilderness. It had just been taken from the Indians for whom Indiana is named. And his father handed him an axe, said, "Help me hack down the trees for farm fields." He was still very young when his mother died. He had less than 1 year of formal education. It was a really hard start to life, which makes it all the more remarkable how far he went.
Yeah, I love the story you relate in the book of his dad. I think he was, what, age 10 or so, when his dad goes to Kentucky to bring him home a wife and leaves him alone
I mean, this blows my mind. I'll be back in a few weeks. I mean, you get a sense of how remote people were when you study the travel distances, which I've gotten to do for 3 different 19th century books. And all through the 19th century, travel times are speeding up and communication is speeding up. But at this point, Lincoln's born in 1809, so it's before 1820. His father's like, "I'm going to go 100 miles back to the old homestead and find me another wife." And that 100 miles is like a 5-day trip one way and 5 days back. And he's going to spend time trying to marry a woman. And he did leave Lincoln and his sister not quite alone. There was a relative around. There were other people around. But if you could just imagine anybody in the audience who's a parent leaving your preteen kids more or less on their own in the house for many days and probably weeks, that's an image that sticks with me a lot.
Yeah, me as well. You have a line in the book I thought really summarized this nicely, which is that we could get to Afghanistan a lot more quickly than you could get from Kentucky to Indiana back then.
Yeah. Yes. Really, really remote.
So talk about the structure of the book. It's this series of conversations that Lincoln has throughout the time of his, I guess, politically active years. You write at the very beginning about wanting to rescue the idea of politicians and politics.
Yeah, or at least be complete about it. We have a very negative view of politicians and politics, and a lot of them have earned it. We should be clear, and it can be a brutal and dirty business, but politics is also the work of democracy. Politics is figuring things out. Politics is realizing that democracy is not necessarily a morality play. Democracy is not necessarily proving your virtue as better than anybody else. It's facing other people who have different interests than you and figuring out some way that you all can serve your various economic and other kinds of interests in a political system. And you need a good politician to do that. And Lincoln was a good politician. I think it's interesting. I mean, the even though Lincoln is so famous, the image of Lincoln changes over time. The Lincoln that my mom grew up with was a very honest man and an upright man, and of course, an inspiring, self-educated man, but a guy who just kind of fell into the presidency almost by accident, almost as a kind of miracle of God, who was just almost too pure to be president, but ended up on the stage. And Lincoln, in reality, was far more calculating than that, and very ambitious, and tried many things to rise in the world, and worked really, really hard before and during his presidency to build and maintain coalitions of people, some of whom we would judge to be terrible people, or at least to hold terrible views. And how could he hold together those coalitions of people to do good things, get good votes out of people with bad ideas?
It's what he says, it's what he doesn't say, and you often focus on that.
Yeah.
He's very good at leaving people with the impression he's answered their questions, and then maybe on reflection,
yeah,
not so much. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, he's a guy who's is known as a talker, as a storyteller, as a jokester, as an entertainer almost. But he was very careful about what he didn't say. And that came through to me in the research. That's another thing that I did not realize when I started this for all the Lincoln books that I had read over time. Some of his associates said that he was almost deceptive in what he would leave out. He could give you the impression that he had revealed all of his plans and intentions when in reality had been so careful that he had revealed nothing. He would fall silent on campaign issues, all of them except the one that he felt was going to be decisive in the campaign. The very last speech of his life, just a few days before his assassination, it's the end of the Civil War, and there is a big question on people's minds that's in the news. And in the speech, he raises the question and he says, "I'm not going to answer that. It's a silly distraction. It's pernicious." And that is just classic. That's characteristic of his style and probably of a lot of political wisdom, is being very careful about what you say.
Let's go through a few of the characters in the book that you write about Lincoln interacting with. And I want to begin with Duff Green. Who was Duff Green? And maybe I can show people those who are watching on our Zoom will see him, but maybe you can describe him. He's quite a character.
Amazing character. Okay, you're holding up a picture of a man with a long white beard. He's toward the end of his life. He doesn't have a lot of hair on the top of his head. He's wearing a baggy coat. He's sitting down, and he has this very long, straight walking stick. And he looks like a guy, kind of a crabby guy. You wouldn't want to mess with this guy. Duff Green was a propagandist, a newspaper man who was involved with multiple presidents, including Andrew Jackson, the founder of the Democratic Party. And in those days, in the 1820s and 30s, he was a pro-equality guy and a pro-democracy guy and a pro-everybody-get-together guy, except that he was also a slave owner. He, like so many people, had that gigantic contradiction when he talked about equality. He meant equality for white men. And in later years, when slavery became the preeminent issue facing the country, he became a pro-slavery propagandist and spoke and wrote obsessively about slavery. But this was a guy who was related distantly by marriage to Abraham Lincoln, who had owned a boarding house where Lincoln stayed when he was a member of Congress, who was for many years in Lincoln's political party, and they were friends. Lincoln was friends with this guy who was a really unpleasant person. I mean, there's a case where he insulted a newspaper man in his newspaper, insulted a congressman so fiercely in his newspaper that the congressman came and beat him and put him in the hospital. I mean, in many ways, just an awful person, but Lincoln made friends with him.
Maybe why he started carrying around that large stick.
And he be ready.
He goes to visit Lincoln in Springfield at the house, or I should say, well, yeah, actually it was at the house. Interestingly, Lincoln met a lot of people in the old, what we now call the old state Capitol building in downtown. Yeah. But this man knew Lincoln. As you mentioned, he was related to Mary Todd through marriage. And you write that he was an envoy of James Buchanan, the outgoing president, who was also an envoy on behalf of the South. And also from the dead hand of the past. What did he want from Lincoln?
He wanted Lincoln. This is the end of 1860. And people in central Illinois are probably going to know this history a little bit more intimately than others. But I'll explain for those who don't. Lincoln was elected as an anti-slavery candidate in November of 1860. Southern states considered this intolerable, where slavery was dominant. And they began declaring their secession from the Union. And lawmakers were attempting some compromise to keep the Union together. And Duff Green, feeling that he was the friend of Lincoln, was going to be the man to go to Springfield to sell it to Lincoln. And he travels on the train from Washington to Springfield. And yes, as the best I can analyze the evidence, they would seem to have met at the Lincoln House. And he talks and talks and talks with Lincoln and tries to get him to endorse this compromise. Now, this is a very powerful thing. This is a thing that's been in the news, by the way.
We're going to get to that, definitely.
Okay, but I'll mention now. Sure. Former President Trump just the other day was saying on the campaign trail, talking about the Civil War. People are talking about the Civil War and the campaign.
Let me read the quote here. The Civil War was so fascinating, so horrible, so many mistakes were made. See, there was something I think could have been negotiated, to be honest with you. I think you could have negotiated that. All the people died. So many people died. You know, that was the disaster. Could this have been negotiated?
Oh, my goodness. There's so much in this quote. There's so much in this quote. First, it's Trump being on brand. I can make a deal. I mean, that's what he says about everything. I have this vague memory. I can't cite it, that he may have even said something like this before. But other people have said it. It is a widespread belief. His former chief of staff, John Kelly, said this once. Some historians have argued this. And in fact, it seems like it should not be that controversial to say, gosh, there should have been some way to avoid that terrible war, the most deadly war in American history. But it wasn't really a negotiable point. It was a conflict over slavery that people had tried to negotiate away for decades by then. And Duff Green's effort was among the very, very, very last efforts before the shooting started. And the agreement that he brought was all Lincoln had to do was endorse a change in the Constitution to enshrine slavery in the Constitution forever.
Just the that. Founders, only that.
Yeah, right? That's all, and a few other things. The founders, as people in this room probably know, avoided the word slavery in the Constitution. I mean, slavery is all over the Constitution, acknowledged and addressed in various ways, but they kept the word out. And now this idea was they were going to put it in, and they were going to say that Congress will never, ever, ever, ever interfere with slavery ever, ever, ever. And this amendment can't be amended, can't be repealed ever, ever, ever. And there were other things as well. And this was ultimately, although Lincoln had the conversation, because he talked to everybody and he tried to get advantage where he could from everybody, this was not a thing that he could do. This was not a thing that his party could do. And as best I can tell, it may not have worked even if they had endorsed it, because there were some Southerners who didn't think that this extreme compromise, so-called, was even good enough for them.
I like how you phrase it in the book. You talk about, and you hinted at this when you mentioned the founders not even wanting to put the word slavery in the Constitution. You know, you'd get phrases like peculiar institution and things like that. But you say parallel revolutions in public opinion made that being compromise, impossible. The North's slow revolution had crystallized public hostility to slavers, while the South's slow revolution exalted it. I should say public hostility to slavery, while the South's slow revolution exalted it. You talk about by the 1830s, Southerners are encouraged not even to go to the North for vacation, lest their minds be poisoned by anti-slavery ideals.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the tragedies of the evolution of public thought in the United States. And I think that all of these nuances, by the way, are current now. They're worth thinking about now, the way that people's thinking evolves, the way that someone on our side in the great political divide says something shocking, and it's nothing that we would have ever endorsed yesterday, but somehow by the day after tomorrow, we're saying this is absolute truth and we have to believe it. That's what polarization can do. And in the South, slavery began and spread, but was widely acknowledged even by the people who practiced it as being bad, as being an evil, as being something that was terrible for Black people and even terrible for the white people who profited from it because it was so morally corrupting. And there were other things they disliked about it. And this was acknowledged. And we can say, of course, totally hypocritical that someone like Thomas Jefferson would acknowledge that slavery was evil and keep practicing it. But at least they acknowledged this was a bad thing that should come to an end. Then there was this conflict over slavery and this evolution in thinking over time, and it became much more common by the 1830s and up until the Civil War to affirmatively say that slavery was good. To go from, well, this is really sad, but we inherited this system and we have a lot of money invested in it, to saying this is the ideal organization of society. And that made it something that was going to be impossible or harder anyway to compromise away. And there was another revolution in the North where there were many people who thought slavery was fine or thought slavery is bad, but it's not really my problem. Slavery is bad, but I'm really kind of afraid of what happens if it ends. Slavery, you know, the people would rationalize. And they continued rationalizing all the way through the end of the Civil War. I mean, we could find someone rationalizing about it today. But more people took stronger stances against slavery, and that also made compromise harder.
Let me reintroduce my guest. Steve Inskeep is the author of Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. He is also, of course, a co-host of NPR's Morning Edition. I spoke with him last week at a live virtual event for public radio listeners across the state. We are going to take a break. When we come back, more with Steve Inskeep. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Steve Inskeep, the author of Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. This conversation was recorded last week at a live virtual event for public radio supporters across Illinois. Before the break, we were talking about, and really we were debunking, former President Donald Trump's recent claim that he thinks the Civil War could have been avoided through a negotiated settlement. The reason former President Trump was talking about this is that another Republican presidential candidate, Nikki Haley, had also made some news recently with her own Civil War analysis. She was asked about the causes of the Civil War at a town hall meeting, failed to identify slavery as a cause. I have to admit, I really struggled to come up with a question for you about this, but I mean, maybe we can talk about what, just to pick a state at random, South Carolina's own ordinance of secession had to say about slavery and the Civil War.
Wow. Well, obviously, South Carolina is central to the story. It was the first state to secede. It was the state where Confederates fired the first shot. And so if you grow up in South Carolina and spend your life in South Carolina, as the former governor of South Carolina did, I mean, you know the history. Haley herself had been involved in getting the Confederate flag off the state capitol. She didn't have zero background in this, but still she strangely avoided the word and then later said, of course, I understand the thing about slavery. I just had certain reasons for avoiding it. I do want to comment on two things, though. First, I'm really grateful to all of these candidates for bringing up the Civil War because it's great for my topic. I wrote this book. I write about the 19th century partly to help illuminate the present. I mean, I'm writing about the past, but it helps me understand the present. But every once in a while, the past just zooms right up and becomes the present, and that has happened. I also want to say, I think that Haley's comment reflects the widespread views of a lot of voters who I have run into who will actually say the Civil War wasn't about slavery, it was about states' rights. And if I can take just 30 seconds at this moment,
please do,
to observe to people in this room. Maybe there's somebody in this room who feels the Civil War was not caused by slavery, and that's cool. Maybe there's somebody who has an honest question and doesn't know. I'll just tell you, the slavery was the cause of the Civil War. We know slavery was the cause of the Civil War because the Southerners who tried to secede and fired the first shot said it was their cause. The ordinances of secession, their declarations of independence as states, universally said slavery was the reason. Slavery was the greatest material interest in the world, according to the Mississippi Ordinance of Secession. And our interest, they said, is with slavery.
Thoroughly identified with slavery. They were very clear in their writing. Yeah, it was very modern. Yes.
Exactly. Thoroughly identified. Not like we sort of feel this way. I mean, we feel so strongly we want to break up the country. Alexander Stevens, vice president of the Confederacy, said that whole thing about all men are created equal was an error. And they were refounding a new country on a better system of inequality and slavery. So it's not a mystery. It wasn't a mystery then. It was about slavery. We can have controversies over various aspects of the long road to war, but the big picture is super clear.
Hot take here, but it strikes me that one of the things that former ambassador, former Governor Haley may be trying to do is what you talk about Lincoln trying to do, which is only saying enough that you need to say to get through the moment, not saying too much. But maybe she's just not nearly as good at it as the great emancipator was.
Thank you. I appreciate that insight. And I think there's something to it. Now, Haley herself, in explaining the gaffe, said, I know all about slavery and I was answering it for this reason. But you can imagine a candidate like Nikki Haley saying to themselves, I can't really argue history with the guy whose vote I want, who thinks that the Civil War was not about slavery. I just want to avoid that question and talk about the thing that is important, that I do want to run on, that I believe that I can affect in some way. You can imagine a candidate saying that or thinking that, but it has to be artfully done. And whatever her motivations was, they didn't seem to work for her.
Well, and I'm no expert on South Carolina politics, but I have heard people who followed her career more closely that this is not an isolated idea of, you know, she did take down the flag, right, over the Capitol, but that was something she had to come to gradually and certainly didn't campaign on it, which is another theme of the book, right? And this is something I know you've talked about, another parallel that comes up of a politician saying what he has to say in the moment to that he thinks he has to say to get elected, and maybe later, as the country drags him along, he can modify his views, is former President Barack Obama and same-sex marriage.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who've drawn that parallel. Even people who worked in Obama's White House saw some comparison. Obama was for civil unions and against same-sex marriage for the first term almost of his presidency, until the moment that he said, I've given a lot of thought and I've concluded that it is right to support gay marriage. Again, the explanation of the president, of the leader in that situation, is I've thought really hard about it, and that is my new position. But it did also, to some extent, track the political reality that it would have been very hard for him to be elected president in 2008 if he supported same-sex marriage. But even at that moment, the country's attitudes were changing. And by 2012, it was a different matter. And as it turned out, there were people who felt that this would hurt Barack Obama politically because he relied on Black voters, and there was less support in the Black community for same-sex marriage. But in our polarized country, it ultimately didn't hurt him. He won re-election. People stuck with him, even if they didn't totally agree with him yet on that issue.
Let's talk about some of the other characters in the book. And this is a woman who is the subject of one of your previous books, Jessie Fremont.
Yeah, an amazing character. She was the daughter of a United States senator, a very powerful and long-lasting United States senator from Missouri. She was extraordinarily smart, very well-educated, fluent in multiple languages, able to talk with ambassadors in Washington, D.C. Her father had brought her to the Senate, to the Library of Congress, to the White House. She then married this guy, John Charles Fremont, who became a great Western explorer, trailblazer, incredibly famous, and a presidential candidate himself at one time before the Civil War, then a general during the Civil War, except Fremont, as I discovered in writing the previous book, Imperfect Union, about him, was a really, really frustrating character. And one of his various flaws was an almost chronic inability to follow orders, which is fine. I probably have trouble following orders myself from time to time.
That's why we're journalists.
In the military, yes. You've got to do what you're told. And he ultimately had a conflict with Lincoln as president of the United States in 1861.
And that conflict had to do with emancipation, which Lincoln would, of course, become greatly known for, but wasn't quite ready to go there yet.
Yeah, wasn't quite ready and did not believe it was Fremont's decision. I mean, all of these things resonate for me in the present day. Fremont, commanding in Missouri, which was an important state where Confederates were gaining ground, felt that he could change the situation with a kind of emancipation proclamation. He said, I'm going to free the slaves of rebels in Missouri. Done. And he began signing deeds of manumission, as they were called. Except at that early point in the war, Lincoln felt that he did not have the legal authority to begin freeing the enslaved. And he also felt that he did not have the political authority, the political will to free the enslaved. He was building those coalitions that we talked about of differing people, including people whose views he disagreed with. And there were people who were loyal to the Union, but who were in slave states or actually owned slaves, and he didn't want to lose their support. He needed to be stronger in those slave states so he wouldn't lose them when the moment came. So the timing was wrong, and Lincoln also felt another thing was wrong, and that is that there's supposed to be civilian control of the military. And a general had done this thing that seemed to Lincoln to be a political act. And he said, this is my choice to decide on. This is my choice for the timing. It is not yours. And he had a conflict with Fremont, which didn't go very well at all. And Fremont was by then on his way to losing his job, although it took a little while longer.
And she did not have a very successful conversation from their perspective with the president.
No. And this is, I mean, I try to tell this book entirely as a series of face-to-face meetings with people throughout Lincoln's life. And Jesse Benton Fremont, in this case, was the person who came as the emissary from her husband fighting the war out in Missouri, to Washington, D.C., where she had known other presidents, where she'd been in the White House many times before, and was just an extraordinary woman for her time. It's stunning to think of what she might have accomplished in a later age when women were allowed more freedom. But she had enough wealth and status and smarts to assert her freedom of action and to assert and demand respect, and to do things that generally only men would be allowed to do, even though she also embraced a kind of feminine role and a kind of traditional femininity. But she would also storm down to the White House to complain to the president on behalf of her husband. This wasn't even the first time she'd been to a president to complain on behalf of her husband. And she went to deliver a letter from John to the president, declining to do what Lincoln wanted him to do. And she said, I'm here to answer any questions that you have. But Lincoln was not, by her account, happy at all to hear this. He just wanted his orders followed.
This is an example, this episode, of Lincoln holding back, not taking the maximalist position for human freedom, right? And you have other examples of where he talks about, is it with Greeley, where he says, I will do... If freeing every enslaved person in the country will preserve the Union, I'll do that. If freeing them only in the South will preserve the Union, I'll do that. If freeing them nowhere will preserve the Union, I'll do that. Talk about this as a political strategy and how he came to emancipation.
Super famous letter. And it's another thing that people debate today. Another great thing about writing about Lincoln, everything about Lincoln is still a subject of debate. You read that letter today, an open letter to Horace Greeley, who had complained publicly about Lincoln failing to act against slavery. You read that letter today, and you can hear Lincoln seeming to say, I don't care about slavery at all. I'll do whatever about slavery. My point is saving the Union. But the larger question was that Lincoln felt that he needed to preserve the country or he wouldn't have anything to say about slavery. That's the first point. The second thing is he felt he needed to act within his constitutional authority. And then the third point is that even as he wrote that public letter, Lincoln had drafted an Emancipation Proclamation, and he was waiting for the right political moment to release it. And read in retrospect, once the proclamation was out, it seems clear that Lincoln was preparing the public mind for freedom. He was saying to conservatives in the North who supported the country but weren't big fans of emancipation, I'm doing emancipation to save the country, which is a thing you can support even if you don't agree with me about the act itself. I'm acting to save the Union, and if I could do that with freeing no slaves, I would do it, but I need to free a lot of them, and that is in fact what I'm going to do.
You know, this gets at the broader question of how we should evaluate people of the past through the lens of our modern sensibilities. How do you think about that? I mean, it's an easier call with, you know, Fort Bragg, right? Bragg was a Confederate. He was a traitor to the country. He was also not a very good general. I've been reading Grant's memoirs. So there's multiple layers of reasons to not name, give him the honor of naming a military base after him. But there are people who say Lincoln is too highly regarded. How do you think about that?
Well, I think that Lincoln is probably more complicated than a lot of the thousands and thousands of books about him have made him. He was a politician. He was Honest Abe, who didn't go around lying, but would withhold things. And sometimes people would feel that he was, in fact, deceptive in that way. He was playing a dirty game. He was a ruthless commander, ultimately commander-in-chief of the Union in wartime. There are a lot of different sides to any historical figure. I think it's okay for us to go back and weigh the judgments and the actions of people in the past. It used to be said, people used to be in some quarters kind of forgiven for slavery because that's just what they did at that time. I would not go that far because there were people as far back as there has been slavery in the United States, there have been people who have said it was wrong and who have known that it was wrong, even as they practiced it. And so it was information that was available to white people that slavery was bad. It wasn't like a big shock. At the same time, I want to recognize the complexity of it, that there were many, many people in the country with many, many different points of view, and that it was a very, very hard problem to build a large enough coalition to do what needed to be done to destroy this tremendous economic interest. So I try to keep it in perspective. And I try also to approach this with a little bit of humility. We presume that we're so much more moral and that we understand so much better, but do we really? There may well be something that we're doing today that seems normal enough to us that 100 years from now, our descendants, you know, if we haven't destroyed the planet, will be looking back and asking, what were they thinking? How could they possibly have done that? And it's a thing that seems normal to us. And that could be something as simple as your drive to work today in a gasoline-powered car. You know, how could they have allowed climate change? Someone may be asking that someday. And so I think perspective on both ends helps a lot, both in judging the past carefully and judging from a place of humility from where we are.
Let me once again reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. We are listening back to a conversation I recorded last week with Steve Inskeep. He is the author of Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. He is also, of course, one of the co-hosts of Morning Edition on NPR. We're going to take a break here, but before we do, I want to mention something we're going to be talking about tomorrow on the program, and that is crime and actual numbers about crime and perception of crime. Homicides, murders are set to have a record decline nationwide since one of the peaks during the pandemic, and yet most Americans think that murder is on the rise. So I just want to know, without looking up the numbers, what do you think of crime in your part of Illinois? Do you think it's going up? Do you think it's going down? We're going to speak with a criminologist who's worked on these issues for decades and looked not only at the numbers of crime and the causes of crime, but how people think about crime and perceive crime. What is the situation in your part of Illinois? You can let us know by leaving a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Or send us an email, talk@21stshow.org. Then tune in tomorrow for that conversation. More with Steve Inskeep after a break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to the conclusion of my conversation recorded last week with Steve Inskeep of NPR. He's the author of the recent book, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. Thinking through how Lincoln built political coalitions, how he built his political power, how he held back and frustrated a lot of the most zealous advocates for people on his side, right? Especially the abolitionists with his slow pace. What lessons are there for today's public officials? Whether you're on the left and you think Joe Manchin is, you know, more harm than good for the Democratic progressive cause, or if you're on the right and you think, you know, we can't compromise on anything, any spending on climate change is a dollar wasted. You have people in, it seems, in Washington just pushing these maximalist positions. And not just for the sake of negotiations, right? We saw that with the House Speaker, what happened to him, Kevin McCarthy, last year. What lessons should we be taking from Lincoln on this?
I would just like to comment that Lincoln seems to me to have had a long-term view of things. He had an idea of what you'd almost call destiny that suggested a relatively limited amount that Americans, that human beings could change what they did, could change the course of history. In fact, if you fully bought some of his ideas, human beings had no free will at all. Nevertheless, he kept trying to change things. But it seems to me that he thought long-term. He thought of American history as a long game. He thought of the line in the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, as being something that they didn't have perfect at the beginning, and they were never going to perfectly attain. But generation after generation after generation, it could be constantly approximated. You could work on it and then work on it a little more. And I think that he saw democracy as a process, which is how I see it. It's nothing is ever over. No battle is ever over. No battle is ever the final battle. And I want to suggest that is profoundly different than the way a lot of people talk today. Former President Trump, in his first campaign in 2016, told his supporters this was their last chance to prevent the destruction of the country. It was going to be flooded with illegal immigrants who were going to cast illegal votes and everything that he said at that time. Last chance. And there's been a lot of that kind of language, and there is more of it coming in 2024. That's just not democracy. It's not life either. I mean, nothing is ever fully solved. But the whole thing of democracy is you have an election, then you have to deal with the other people who are in the government because it's going to be typically a divided government of some kind. And you make the best deal that you can. And you don't try for moral purity because you'll have a different idea of what it is than everybody else. The system falls apart if you do that. You make the best deal that you can. And you don't have to change your basic beliefs, but you make the best deal you can, then you go have another election and see if you can change things a little bit more. And that's just not a universally popular attitude at the moment.
You mentioned the rhetoric that says this is the last chance, we're in a state of emergency. I think some of our colleagues in the media have participated in this idea that we are in a constant state of catastrophe for decades now. How are you approaching, and how is Morning Edition approaching this incredible year that we're about to enter in terms of being responsible conveyors of information to voters?
Well, I want to cover the gravity of this situation properly and in perspective and calmly. I recognize that for a great many people, the situation is urgent. And there is a lot that we have to work hard on and get right. And I also just want to keep perspective on things. I think you made a comment about the news media contributing. There are a lot of urgent breaking news stories about things that could happen. You listen for the word could. It could mean the destruction of blah, blah, blah. Well, that means it hasn't yet. So, I mean, pay attention, but let's wait and see if it does. Because a lot of the could stories don't pan out. A lot of things that could go wrong don't go wrong or don't entirely go wrong, or we somehow muddle through. So you have to keep perspective at all times. At the same time, I think that there are a lot of serious things being said on the campaign trail. The Iowa caucuses are coming up, and the leading candidate has said that he wants to terminate portions of the Constitution, has said that he wants to be a dictator only on the first day, he says, as if it were possible to only be a part-time dictator, has said a lot of other things, and has made a lot of allegations about the other side. I mean, there's serious, serious things being batted around, and we have to report them intensively and get you the facts intensively of all candidates. I mean, what is the president doing? How is the money being spent? Where was the defense secretary during those days he was missing in the hospital the other day? On and on and on. And even if it's a story that the Democrats would not see as a story like Hunter Biden, well, it's happening. And so we cover it. And it's just like, let's look at where the facts lead us or where they don't lead us and where a story falls apart. We need to relentlessly report this. But I think the fundamental answer to your question for reporters is we don't need some new model of journalism where we're all supposed to be advocates for or against some person. We need to do better at upholding the standards that we already have, at reporting properly and accurately and fairly in context, ruthlessly uncovering facts and giving them to you in a level-headed way and with proper perspective.
Context, I think, is key. And it can be very challenging to do that context, especially in a live interview situation. I think about that every day as somebody who does a live talk show. Jonathan Swan, the reporter, I think he's with the New York Times now, was widely credited with a pretty tough interview of former President Trump during his time. He has said on Twitter back in October, the forensic political interview is all but dead in the U.S. You yourself, do you have the distinction of being the last NPR anchor to attempt to interview former President Trump? And maybe you can,
yeah. So far as I know, I'm the only NPR anchor to interview former President Trump. And we had an interesting conversation until he hung up the phone. I would talk to him again, I suppose, if we get the opportunity. But Swan makes a really interesting point. Generally speaking, the newsmaker interview, so-called, is just a very different animal than it was. And part of it is that just so many people have said so many things that are just transparently false, that what any given official says no longer carries very much weight. Everything seems kind of overexposed and underexposed at the same time. And you don't really know what's going on. And any given interview may not add a lot of insight. It's a very, very frustrating time. And I think that we still do have to interview politicians, ask them questions, and see what answers we get back. But then we have to add in tons and tons of context, a word that you mentioned a moment ago. Ideally, I mean, sometimes you talk to politicians live. It's breaking news. But ideally, you don't talk to everybody live. You talk to them recorded. You give them lots of time and space. And then you can present the interview very carefully with lots of other context and so forth. That doesn't mean that your live talk show is a bad idea. You know, there are different ways to do this, but you want to keep adding more different voices, different perspectives, fact checking and everything else, so that you get a whole picture of what's going on rather than letting that one newsmaker be the narrator because they may be an unreliable narrator.
I think I know what your answer is because you've sort of hinted at it, but you do hear calls to why are we so-called platforming this individual? I'll put my own cards on the table here. I do think you need to hear from everybody because, you know, there's no sense in sticking your head in the sand. There's a way to do it and a way not to. But what do you make of calls that the media ought to be, you know, not so-called platforming certain individuals, President Trump
well,
among them?
Well, that's basically, yeah. I understand the point. I mean, you maybe don't want to give a free hour to the KKK or whatever, but honestly, I've interviewed David Duke. I mean, you do hear from all kinds of people, and here is why. And you know this. I can tell that you know this, and I bet a lot of our listeners know this. It's a democracy, and the person who is wrong still has power because they have the vote. And that's going to continue to be true so long as we have a democracy. And that means that you need to hear the other guy, even if he's never going to persuade you because he's full of lies or whatever you believe, but you need to know what his line is. You need to have some idea, the best intelligence you can, about what he's doing, because you want to keep track of him and you want to be able to counter his arguments and see if you can peel away a few of his supporters. And for that reason, it matters a lot to hear the person that you disagree with as well as the person that you agree with. People who talk about platforming, their basic assumption is that news is propaganda. You know, it's all brainwashing. And so just be sure to do the brainwashing for my side. Don't do the brainwashing for the other side. That's not how I view it. I view myself as working for an intelligence agency for citizens, so-called. And my job is to bring you information about everybody.
This dovetails nicely, I think, with a question we got from a listener. Terry asks, do you think it was common in the schools of South Carolina, I think this is came in around the time we were talking about Nikki Haley, do you think it was common in the schools of South Carolina to have taught that the cause of the Civil War was not slavery? And I don't know that you can speak to the curriculum, yeah, but this gets at what Lincoln trying to meet people where they are. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't studied the South Carolina curriculum. And so I'm going to be fair and reserve judgment on that. But I have seen textbooks from different eras and different states over different generations. There used to be a lot of things said about slavery that were not what, you know, maybe we would agree with today.
This gets at Lincoln, though, trying to meet people where they are and approach them on their terms, right? And that's something I don't think all of our politicians feel like they need to do today. Sometimes,
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Lincoln reached out to literal slave owners and tried to get something of value out of them. Lincoln reached out to radicals like Frederick Douglass, who had escaped from slavery, who called Lincoln racist, but also supported Lincoln's broad cause. And Lincoln tried to make common cause with Douglass. And Lincoln was even meeting with people like that propagandist Duff Green that we talked about at the beginning. Couldn't ultimately agree with them, but Lincoln was just in there trying to see what he could gain.
Sarah wants to know, if Abraham Lincoln were alive today, what advice would he give to voters who are deciding the next person who will occupy the White House?
I'm not going to tell you who Lincoln would have told you to vote for, but Lincoln believed in the rule of law. He believed in the Constitution and the rule of law. He did not believe in doing the right thing, even as he defined it. He thought the rule of law is what keeps us from chaos, and I think he'd be voting for someone who he felt would uphold the Constitution.
We can maybe talk about habeas corpus and some other aspects of the rule of law another day. There's nuance, right?
Yeah. I mean, we could have that long argument. Lincoln had some cases where he defied the Supreme Court while he was president, yes.
You end the book, the last conversation that Lincoln has, the last face-to-face meeting is with Mary Todd, his last day with her, and his assassination that night. You write, at the war's end, he was killed by a man who believed that he was changing history, but Lincoln had made his impression. There's a way of looking at Booth's actions as being wildly successful because he set the North on a path where it won the war but lost the peace, at least for a long time. What do you think of that?
I don't know if that's exactly true, because it wasn't just the man, the personality of Lincoln, that stood in the South's way. There was a big political problem that gets back to what we were saying before about a democracy. In a democracy, the guy who's wrong gets to vote. The South had taken itself out of the political equation by trying to secede, but sooner or later was going to have to be let back in and was going to have immense political power once they did. And that was going to be a real challenge. That was the central challenge of Reconstruction, or one of them, was how do we, the victorious Union, let Southern states back into the Union without them suddenly winning an election and taking over the government that just defeated them? Super hard challenge. And you can argue there are people who will say the South has won the peace. But what that really means is that the South has resumed its place as a part of the United States. Its voters are many and numerous, and its ideas, whatever we consider them, good or bad, and there's a great variety, are extremely influential. And it can't be otherwise so long as we are a democracy. I think Lincoln would have been a very different president than Andrew Johnson, his successor, definitely. He certainly was a better president than Andrew Johnson, but the broad political picture would have been the same.
Well, Steve Inskeep, I'm sure you need to get to bed and wake up in just a few hours to bring us the news on Morning Edition tomorrow. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been an honor. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Steve Inskeep is the author of Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. I spoke with him last Wednesday evening at a live virtual event for supporters of public radio stations across Illinois. And that's all the time we have for our program today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.